My name is Carol, and I'm an alcoholic. A rabbi and his wife were seated at dinner one night talking about their son, Irvin, and what he might become when he grew up. So the rabbi said, well, we'll test him. So out on the table, he put a $20 bill, a bottle of gin, and a Bible. Then they called Irvin in to see which one he'd pick up. Now, if he picks up the $20 bill, he's going to be a businessman, an accountant or something like that. If he picks up the gin bottle, he's going to open up a liquor store or a cigar store or something like that. And if he picks up the Bible, he's going to be a rabbi maybe. Well, they called Irvin in. Irvin picked up the $20 bill and stuffed it in his pocket. Grabbed with the other hand the bottle of gin and slapped the Bible under his arm and walked out the door. The rabbi says, hey, he's going to be a Catholic priest. I jotted down some notes. I just turned 70. I have moments when I know the word, but it just doesn't come up. Which reminds me of Sam and Sally seated on the front porch in the mountains of my home state of North Carolina in rocking chairs. They're old, just sitting there quietly rocking away. Sally turns to Sam and says, Sam, you know what would be good? He said, what, Sally? She said, great big dish of ice cream smothered in chocolate syrup. He said, you know, that does sound good. Why don't I go get us one? She said, good, do that. But make sure you write it down. You know how you forget things. He said, oh, I don't need to write down one thing. I can remember ice cream. So he goes off and he comes back with two ham sandwiches. And she examines the sandwich and she looks up at him and she said, Sam, I wanted mayonnaise, not mustard. Then there's the census taker. He's going through town counting noses and how many people live in a house and what their names are. And he runs into the house of this woman who has three sets of twins, Polly and Jolly and Mike and Ike and so forth. And he takes down all the names and a bit amazed that they had nothing but twins. And he looks up at her and he says, can I ask you a personal question? She said, yes. He said, tell me, do you always get twins? She said, Lord knows there were hundreds of times we got nothing. Then there is the... then there is the farmer going down the road with a truckload of manure. And truck breaks down in front of a mental institution. And over the wall pops this head of an inmate. And he says to him, Mr. Farmer, what you got there? He said, I got a truckload of manure. I said, what you going to do with it? I said, I'm going to put it on the strawberries. He said, you know, they may think we're crazy in here, but we put whipped cream on ours. Finally, there is this rather proper French poodle that moves into an upscale suburban neighborhood. And all the boy dogs are sniffing around to see which one is going to win her favor. And so three dogs come ambling up, but she's smart. She's going to test and see which one is the smartest. One is a Dalmatian, one's a Dachshund, and one's a Mexican Chihuahua. And she looks over at the Dalmatian and she says, "Would you please use the words cheese and liver in a sentence?" And he growls back, "I hate cheese and liver." She turns to the next dog, a Dachshund, and asks the same question. The Dachshund said, "Oh, I love cheese and liver." She turns to the Chihuahua, and the Mexican Chihuahua looks at her, looks at the other dogs, and says, "Liver alone, cheese mine." I've been to a lot of AA conventions, sometimes as a speaker and sometimes not. You know, it's possible to speak too much for those of you who do a lot of speaking. Sometimes you just need to sit back and listen. And, of course, being what we are, we always have to watch out for that ego, which is ever there. But I want to take a moment to thank Tom and his wife, Cindy, for being absolutely as hospitable and cordial and helpful as any two people could be. I want to thank Wendy and her husband, Eric, for their hospitality and their goodwill. They're just lovable people. I want to thank also John Esquaga. Is that right? Is that correct pronunciation? For the generous hospitality bestowed on the Sierra Nevada roundup in a place where all the personnel are friendly. The food was beyond comparison. The facilities are comfortable. It's just been like a little town in here. I want to thank, too, the Sierra Nevada AA who come together once a year to share their experience, strength, and hope with each other and to enjoy one another. And also, finally, all the speakers and the leaders who have contributed to making this an absolutely exceptional, and I say that with absolute sincerity, exceptional convention of AA. Thank you so much. Now, to qualify, my birthday was on the 13th of August when I celebrated my 27th year in Alcoholics Anonymous. As I said, I grew up in the state of North Carolina. I think I'll always miss it. I think we're always a part of the soil we come out of. We always look back to it. Of course, the truth is, as Tom Wolfe said, you can't go home again. It's never the same after all these years. I just went to a 55th high school class reunion. I'd never been to one before. And I was the leanest one there. Those people eat for recreation. They thought I was sick or something. It's interesting, too, how people back east always refer to going out west, but people out west always refer to going back east. And of course, the reason for that is because the whole culture started on the eastern seaboard, and except for the Hispanic influence, which is great on the West Coast. I had a father who was an alcoholic and died at the age of 56. He drank too much, he smoked too much, and he was extremely handsome and loved the women. And on top of it, did his homework and had 5 children. And he died back when people did, it was a disgrace to be labeled an alcoholic. It's not so much so now, thank God. But he died early and I adored him. My older brother is an alcoholic. His story is in the big book, the revised big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He lives in Key West, Florida now. His story is the one entitled, A Five-Time Loser Wins, in case you want to check up on my brother. He's the eldest, and I'm the youngest, and there's a great bond between us like no other of the siblings. We're very close, and I get back to see him as much as possible in Key West. Have you ever been to Key West? That's a crazy place. And my brother says, yeah, we're all crazy, but at least we own it. And it's a very peaceful place. So I enjoy that. I grew up in a small town of about 25,000 people, a town where you didn't even latch your screen at night. And in high school, everybody played baseball, basketball, football, track. Everybody went out for the sports, whether you were good or not. And everybody gathered after football games at the same little store for sandwiches and hamburgers and things after games. Every Saturday night, there was a teenage dance. It was a good childhood. And a good place to live, which is how every town should be. Things even there have changed, though. I was a leader in high school. I was one of those goody-two-shoe types who wound up being president of the class and best all round and most likely to succeed and all that sort of stuff. I didn't smoke, drink, curse, or fool around. I left high school for college. I got through college without drinking, smoking, cursing, or fooling around. I did a tour of duty in the Navy without drinking, smoking, cursing, or fooling around. And then I went to the Episcopal Seminary in New York City. I left seminary smoking, drinking, cursing, and cursing. Got married. My last year in the Navy, had 4 sons. My wife was from my hometown. We'd known each other all our lives. She came from a family of all girls and wound up having a family of all boys. And even 10 years into the marriage, she was asking me questions about boys because she didn't know, you know, what makes them tick. I'm not sure anybody does. But we lost one after birth. The eldest, who had had a bout with drugs, died of AIDS 11 years ago, leaving me with 2 sons. The second son is a Roman Catholic priest. People ask him, how that ever happened. He said, my dad taught me too well. And then my youngest son, Philip, who frequently accompanies me when I travel around, is read last night and is seated on the front row. He's the runt of the litter, but a grand companion, and also on the program, of course. And it's a joy to be able to travel with him. We aren't so much father and son. When they get to be 35, they're more like brothers or pals, as it should be. My drinking started out socially, as I said, in seminary with a glass of wine. Then I discovered if one glass made you feel that good, two made you feel better. So, and then I discovered they sold the stuff in the grocery store. So it was a loaf of bread, a bottle of sherry, and then at night when I was studying, if I had had too much coffee, I could drink a glass of sherry, get sleepy, and catch 4 hours sleep. Because seminary is not easy. 3 years in New York. That progressed. And within 10 years after the first drink, I was a full-blown, dependent, reckless, crazy alcoholic. It had gotten to the point that even on Sunday mornings, I could not say Mass or preach a sermon without a couple of glasses of wine before the service. Now, don't you know those were great sermons? They say that drunks are either lovers or fighters. Well, I was a sickening, maudling, all-hands lover. And did some things I'm not particularly proud of. I remember I used to just drive around, and my car would just automatically stop in front of little tilted cocktail glasses and bars, liquor stores. It just automatically just stopped there. And one night, I was in one of the suburban towns. I can't name it because it might identify somebody, but stopped in front of this bar. And I went in, and there's nothing, no one seated there but men all around the bar. Great big mean looking men. And I sat down tremulously, and the guy next to me said, let me buy you a drink. Of course, if you go in a bar with a collar on, you never have to buy a drink. There are enough guilty people in there. Before you know it, you've got 6 or 7 lined up in front of you. These great big bowls of popcorn. And the guy turned to me and he said, what are you into? I said, what do you mean? He said, girls or boys? I said, what you got? Well, you laugh at that, but when you're drunk, you don't care. You don't care. I've been in all kinds of bars, and I did all kinds of things, and I have to say that in case it might be liberating for someone else. He was a vice squad agent. Asked me if I wanted to go home with him because he had this dish at home waiting for him. Dish meaning female. And I said, sure. Well, I'm pouring down the bourbons. And he said, will you follow me? And he made a call to make sure she was there. And I went home with him, and we're sitting in the living room drinking more drinks. And I don't remember all the details of the evening or what really happened, except that she began to undress me. Notice how quiet everybody gets. It's going to get better. We do like sex, don't we? Huh? There's not a person in here without a sexual history. Some better than others. And some climbing the walls. Anyway, I wind up in bed with these two. She was in the middle, of course. And for the life of me, I really don't remember what happened. I really don't. And as drunk as I was, I don't know that much could have happened. But I was young at the time, and that's one of the miracles of being young. Anyway, the next morning I woke up. Oh, big R, remorse. Oh, big R was hovering over me. And I didn't know, where are my keys, where's my wallet, where are my trousers? Didn't know where anything was, so I moved to the side of the bed and put on my trousers and left the two of them there in the bed, not knowing what I had done or not done. And so I went into the kitchen and I found a bottle of vodka. I made coffee and laced the coffee with the vodka and went out on the patio. The cop came out, sat down. He looked at me rather studiously and said, "Hey, Father, you know what?" I said, "What?" "What?" He said, "You are a real bear in the bed." Well, that made me feel better. I had never in my entire life, done such a thing. I was a virgin when I was married. I was faithful to my wife. I had never stepped out on anybody. I'm not the kind. Faithful and true. But it just goes to prove what you surrender when you get drunk. You surrender all judgment and morals and everything else. There's a recovery house in Los Angeles. When people enter, they warn them that everybody here, put a lock on your possessions because everybody here is a liar, a cheat, and a thief until they recover. Well, anyway, the drinking got worse and worse and worse. I wound up being hospitalized from time to time. Wound up in a psychiatric. I had about a half a dozen psychiatrists before it was over with. And I could make them believe most anything I wanted them to believe. And until I ran into this one dude, and he figured he could cure me with electricity. At a very, very, very prominent hospital in Pasadena. And so I had 9 brain shock treatments to cure alcoholism. Now, isn't that a joke? Why, if it could, we'd be shooting people with electricity all over the place. So I had all these doctors. I was hospitalized from time to time. And most of my doctors drank too much themselves, so they'll never call you an alcoholic. Finally, a wise old priest, a Roman Catholic priest, Father Don Lynch, God rest his soul, he's gone now, came to my house one Saturday, and I was a mess. And he sat down in the living room with me and he said, "Father Barber, I'm going to tell you something." He said, "We people in Alcoholics Anonymous, we never tell anybody they're an alcoholic. We may tell them they have a drinking problem, but we never tell them they have to come to that themselves. But I'm going to break that rule. I'm going to tell you something. Because you are an egotistical bastard. You are an alcoholic. And if you don't do something about it, you're going to be dead in a year. And you know, that registered. And that very evening, I went into a recovery house. I slipped after a month, and then I slipped after 3 months, and then finally got the message. And that was on August 13th that I had my last drink 27 years ago. Now, I hear people all the time talking about the difference between religion and spirituality. Well, come on. Come on. The Latin basis for religion is the regarde. And it simply means to bond with God. That's what the word means. Spirituality and bonding with God are the same thing. I think what most people do mean when they say that they're spiritual but they're not religious is that they are opposed to institutional church, institutionalized religion. And so am I. I am so sick of bureaucracies and politics. Every institution in America except AA is shot through with politics. Everything from medical care, hospitals, restaurants, schools, everything shot through with politics. And it makes me sick, and it's not really in keeping with good religion. So I want to talk about something very important, the most important thing in spirituality this morning. I want to talk about praying, real praying. First of all, I believe there's one God, one higher power. But obviously, as a Christian, I believe that that one God revealed himself in three ways: Father, Son, Holy Spirit. That we're made in his image. That means made in his image. That means there's a little God in all of us, deep, 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 deep down in yourself, there's God. And there's a way in which you can say, God is me. But I'm not God. Okay? And getting in touch with that thing deep, deep, deep inside is what praying is. And the best praying we ever do is when our backs are against the wall. Remember? There are no atheists in foxholes. Now, this God who revealed himself in three ways made us, and we're made in his image. Therefore, we have three little parts to us. We have a body, we have a mind, we have a spirit. Now, we all know that the three things that you must have for a healthy body are proper diet, proper exercise, and proper rest. Right? That's common knowledge. But a lot of people ignore the fact that we need the same thing for the mind. The mind must have proper diet, exercise, and rest. And the same thing for the spirit. The spirit must have proper diet, exercise, and rest. Now we know that proper diet for the body is, you know, the right minerals and protein and vitamins and all that. And we know that exercise is working that body, because if you don't use it, you lose it. And exercise is just as important as medicine, maybe more so. And that rest for the body is sleep. We need sleep because that's when the body repairs itself. And so forth. Now for the mind, proper diet has to do with knowledge. Just as with the body, if you feed the body nothing but Twinkies, you're going to have a Twinkie body. And if you feed the mind nothing but trash, you're going to have a trashy head. You are what you read and study. And knowledge, and hopefully from the knowledge will come wisdom. Now, exercise for the mind is problem solving. I took algebra and trigonometry. I've never used them, but they taught me how to think. They taught me how to solve problems. That was the good part. Now, the mind needs rest. How do you rest your mind? You can never put it to sleep. Rest for the body, for the mind is laughter. If we could not laugh, we would go insane. And as far as we know in creation, we're the only creature capable of real humor. Humor solves the incongruities of life, makes sense of living. It was, who was the great, here goes the word again, the great psychiatric hospital, oh dear me, what was his name? This is a senior moment I'm having here. His name will come to him and then I'll tell you. Anyway, he said, one of the greatest psychiatrists of the country before he died said, there are two attributes that the mentally ill always lose first. A sense of gratitude and a sense of humor. And as they get well, the two attributes they seem to gain first are a sense of gratitude and a sense of humor. And we know that if two men are undergoing an operation for open heart surgery, and in one bed, one is grateful and cracking jokes, and in the other bed is a grouch who's not grateful for a damn thing and never thanks anybody for anything and certainly never laughs, the man with the gratitude and the sense of humor will actually heal faster. So the mind needs humor for rest. Now to the soul. The spirit. Actually, we speak of spirit because soul is psyche, soul is mind. The spirit of a person. Proper diet for the spirit is prayer. And there's a balanced diet and there's an unbalanced diet. Proper exercise for the spirit are acts of mercy. Mercy on people who are suffering. And in our case, the other alcoholic. We pray for them and we extend a hand to them with compassion and mercy. That's prayer. And then finally, rest for the soul, for the spirit, will be found in silence. Get quiet. Find a quiet place. Sit. Don't talk. Don't even think. Let God. We are so busy telling God what to think and do. We're so busy wrapped up in our own faults and virtues that we don't get quiet. And it's when we get quiet that things happen. So if for the body you need exercise and diet and rest for the soul, you need the same thing, and the mind. Now, I know this sounds a bit academic, but this is a spiritual hour, right? And I'm doing my best to keep the flavor of a particular kind of religion out of this and just stick with the spiritual aspects, all of which you'll find in the big book of AA. Now, there are five classical modes of prayer. And if you don't do anything but go home with these in your head, then I will feel that I've been somewhat of a success. Five kinds of prayer, and I'm going to start with the highest, the most difficult, and work down to the easiest. The first and the highest form of prayer known to man is called adoration. Adoration is when in silence you just sit with God. It's like a parishioner said to St. John Vianney once. For years he just came into chapel and would sit and stare up at the altar and the cross and just sit there. And Blessed John Vianney asked him one day what he was praying about. He said, "Oh, I'm not praying about anything. I'm just looking at him, and he's looking at me." A love affair. Adoration is like one Sunday after Sunday school, the Sunday school was letting out, and this little boy came. His dad was sitting in the parish hall drinking coffee, waiting for him. The little boy came running by looking for his daddy all over the place, and finally he spotted him. And he ran directly to him and jumped up on his lap, threw his arms around his neck. His dad put his arms around him, and they just sat there holding each other. The kid wasn't asking for anything. "Billy, hit me. Give me a quarter for a Coke." None of that. They just held each other. Just enjoyed holding each other. That's the highest kind of prayer there is. Just enjoying being in the presence of your higher power who created you and made you like him. In short, made you to love him. That's why we were made. We're busy doing a lot of things, but we can't be too busy loving God and letting him love us. That's the highest kind. Next is the prayer of thanksgiving. That was adoration. If you want to remember an acrostic, ATCIP. This is the way I got through school. CIP, ATCIP, will be the first letter of each of the five kinds of prayer. A is for adoration. T is for thanksgiving. God has two dwelling places. One is in heaven, and the other is in a grateful heart. And I tell little children, if you want to learn how to be thankful, sit in a chair, pull the chair up next to the window, and start with your big toe. I've got 10 toes. 10 fingers. I almost lost one. But 10 fingers. I have 2 legs to stand on. 2 thighs. Something in between them. 2 lungs. 2 eyes, 2 ears, 2 nostrils. You know, God gave us 2 of almost everything. So if one isn't working, the other takes over. But he only gave us 1, you know what? And he only gave us 1 mouth. And I rather suggest that he meant for us to use them half as much as everything else. But simple lessons in thanksgiving begins in this house you live in. This house you live in is an expression of you. This house you live in is the encasement of the three yous, your mind and your body and your soul. This is it. And you see that external form, you can't see all the other, but the other manifests itself through it. And there's something about people who are grateful. They exude a kind of aura. I sit at night sometime in my little bungalow with my boxer dog and my piano and my books. I have plenty to eat. I have a first-class bed. Most important piece of furniture in a house is a bed, whether you're alone in it or not. And I sit and I think, you know, looking around this world, I'm rich beyond measure. I have a dentist, a good doctor. I have friends. I have two wonderful sons. Oh, I failed to mention my wife died 15 years ago of an aneurysm, so that's why there are just the three of us left. Grateful. Grateful. Adoration, just enjoying the company of God. Like the old couple that sit in the den watching TV and they sit there all evening and don't say a word to each other, but adore each other. Just being near them. Thanksgiving, second form of prayer. Third form. That's at now. A for adoration, T for thanksgiving, and then CIP. C is for confession. The best way to end the day before you turn over and go to sleep, and I heartily suggest knees, because sometimes it's like they say in AA, you get the body there, the mind will follow. Get your knees bent on the side of your bed, the soul will follow. But even if you're just lying there, go through the things you've done that day that you know are wrong, even the little things. And tell God how sorry you are about them. Sorry not because you have any fear of hell. Sick of that stuff. But sorry because you have hurt the one who loves you. That's what it's about. God's not no taskmaster waiting to send people to hell. What kind of a creator is that? He's a lover who is hurt when we don't return the love. So, we tell him what we've done that's wrong. And you know what? If you can do it with your kids, Jesus said it, you know, if you, being evil, know how to give your children good gifts, how much more does your Father know how to give you good gifts? Waiting to give you things. Get rid of the trash. Dump your garbage at night. That's why the program has recommendation in the steps for an inventory. Can't go through life lugging around a garbage can full of stuff. Dump it. I've heard many an inventory. It's called confession. It's called inventory. Whatever you want to call it. I is for intercession. The program of AA, we pray for the person who's out there still suffering. And we know they're suffering, don't we? If you ever get tempted, just call to mind how miserable you were when you were on the sauce. And everybody will get tempted. Intercession, praying for others. And people say, well, you know, what good does that do?
The minute you start praying for another human being, you are in the company of God caring for that human being. That's why intercession is important. And you bring to bear godly power by praying for someone else. You cut loose energy. You cut loose the power of God in the world. And for the alcoholic that still suffers. Somebody's doing some praying in AA because people are always coming through the doors. Now more than ever. It's one of the most infamous organizations on the face of the earth. International. And it started out with very humble origins. And with people very critical of it. And as long as we hold on to those traditions, and incidentally, I think, wouldn't it be wonderful if the church followed the traditions of AA? If it owned no property, was self-supporting through its own contributions, did not engage in political controversy, concentrated only in saving the souls of people, gosh, the church would be booming. But we're so big into dressing up and getting involved in things that we shouldn't be involved in, and creating bureaucracies, when we're all of us, fallible, vulnerable, weak human beings. From the Pope to Barber. All the way down. And we human beings are capable of immense evil. All you got to do is turn on the TV. Immense. A man shoots his wife and all of his kids. A woman drowns her kids in a bathtub. Immense evil. Genocide, extermination of whole races, evil, and yet we're capable of great good. Mother Teresa, she dumped the hierarchy. She dumped the bureaucracy. She got busy in India picking up half-dead people off the street. That's a saint. Don't ever think she got mixed up in politics. Never. Saints don't do that. Intercession. Praying for other people. You should have a little piece of paper with names on it. The folks you're going to pray for. A for adoration. T for thanksgiving. C for confession. I for intercession. And the final and the least important form of prayer, though important, but the least important, is called petition. Gimme. I want. I need. I gotta have. And you know, I'm afraid, even with me sometimes, that comprises most of the prayer in the evening. Do you think he doesn't know what you need? There's a wonderful prayer in the prayer book. Almighty God, you know our needs before we ask and our ignorance in asking. Give us those things of which we are not worthy. God knows our needs. Your wants and your needs, two different things. You can have a 12-year-old who wants a motorcycle. And you want him to have a motorcycle someday, maybe, but not at 12 years of age, so you say no to him. Not no, but hell no. Really no. Now when he gets to be 18, to the same question you say yes, because you're ready for one. Well, as ready as anybody gets for a motorcycle. Right, Eric? God has three ways of answering our petitions. Yes. No. Wait. That's the heavy one. That's the heavy one. You know, if God had given me everything I ever prayed for when I asked for it, I would be more screwed up than I am now. I really would be. What we want, what we need at the moment are two different things. Ask and you'll receive according to the will of your higher power. Now, when you reach, so you're going to remember that now. A is for, T is for, C is for, I is for, P is for, give me. you have to live with him, don't you, huh? Well, you're a good class this morning. That's great. Now I think I'll just get down to some. Got through that a little quicker than I thought. I'll get down to some gutsy, heartfelt stuff. That was all a bit academic, but I think it's important. The big book is academic in many ways. I have discovered that when it comes to spirituality and AA, that it's absolutely essential to acknowledge a higher power. Absolutely essential. And that higher power does not have to conform to a Christian or a Hebrew or an Islamic or Buddhist form. It's just God, the higher power. And that God shows you what he's like. You don't have to have a prescribed form to show you what he's like. But a higher power is essential. The program, the steps are all based on that. So therefore, you would have to conclude that Alcoholics Anonymous is a spiritual program. That's all there is to it. It's a spiritual program. And if you try to work it and say it's not, you can get along for a while and fellow members will help you. But in the final analysis, you're going to have to come to terms with the fact that it's a spiritual program. And when it comes to living spiritually, I've discovered that somehow we work out a way of keeping our feet on the earth. Very important. Keeping our feet on the earth, but also keeping our heads and our hearts in heaven. Above. Things above this earth. And better than this earth. Spiritually, I have come to the conclusion in these 70 years that we don't have a single thing to give God. Not a thing that he wants except one thing. Our wills. And those 70 years that I've lived have been nothing more than learning how to turn my will over to the care of God as he understands it, as I understand him. The will. My boxer. My relationship with that boxer is sort of like God's relationship with me, you know. That boxer is dumb sometimes. And she does naughty things. But you know, she loves me to death. And is rather forgiving. And is incapable of conceiving what I am as a human being. Doesn't understand full sentences, only single words. They pick up on the affect of what you say, the feeling behind what you say. They pick up on that very fast. They know what you're saying by the affect. But that dog loves me, and I love that dog. And I'll do nothing to harm that dog. I certainly wouldn't send that dog to hell. Now, if I'm not going to send my dog to hell, God ain't going to send me to hell. I think the only people that will wind up in a hellish situation are those who want to. And there are people who want to. There are probably dogs that don't want a master. But that dog has got to surrender to my will. She will not potty in the house. She will come when she's called. And I will feed her and water her and take care of her. The gap between God and man is pretty great. But isn't it wonderful that a finite creature like ourselves is capable, just capable of contemplating the infinite? We can't define the infinite, but we can contemplate it. Now let me tell you, that's powerful stuff. And that means mankind is powerful stuff too. Because unlike the dog cannot contemplate how infinitely superior I am to her. But God can. With us. And we with God. Now, there is a myth. A myth in theology is not something that is not true. We refer to the creation as the creation myth. A myth in theology is something that is so true that the only way you can tell it is in a simple story, like Adam and Eve. It's so true. We don't have all the details and facts, but it's so true we have to tell it in a simple story. There's a myth about Satan. He's standing on the cliff, and unlike our common cartoon figure of Satan in a suit of red underwear, the pitchfork, Satan, more like Milton's Paradise Lost, Satan is handsome and dynamic and powerful. He's standing on this cliff, the most handsome creature in all of creation. And then he hears that there has been born into the world someone more beautiful than he. And he says to himself, I will scar him. I will make him horrible looking. I alone will be the most beautiful. And so in the world comes this man. And he scars him. His head and his hands, his feet and all that stuff. 3 days after the scarring, all of a sudden this man emerges alive, showing scars. But what has happened? The scars have become and have made him more beautiful than ever. And you are that way. Never cover up your warts. Never cover up your scars. They're your beauty marks. And the stuff that happened in your drinking days that most people would be ashamed of. I mean, hell's bells, going to bed with a vice squad cop and his and his sweetheart and not knowing what on earth you did or didn't do, except he said you were like a bear. That made me feel good. I'm no longer ashamed of that scar. Or as my son was reminding me, he said, "Dad, don't forget to tell the story about sitting on the front porch with a can of Coors, and you pull the stereo out on the front porch and started playing Beethoven so loud that every neighbor could hear it. And then you parked the car in the middle of the street so cars would have to stop and listen to it." "And the cops came and handcuffed you. So don't forget to tell that one." So there you are. What was the other? Oh, giving them the finger. This should be a lesson. If you use that finger long enough, it gets bandaged. Yeah, it's the wrong finger. It's the wrong finger.
Yeah.
He said, "Don't forget to tell them about..." There was a bar about three, four blocks down from Camden Court where we lived, called the Sword and the Crossbow. I walked down there in my underwear one night. In my underwear. I can't conceive of myself doing that. I remember my drinking had led me to lesser and lesser and smaller parishes. And I wound up in Goodland, Kansas. I don't know if there's anybody here from Kansas or not, but if I never go back to Kansas, it'll be all right. But I was in Kansas, and it was really at the bottom of my drinking. I was the worst ever. I would get up in the morning and start out with sherry wine just to steady my hand so I could shave. And I'd drink wine until noon, and then I'd eat lunch, take a nap, get up, start on bourbon. I had a parishioner once who made a Freudian slip and called me Father Bourbon. And then I'd drink bourbon. And of course the depression was even greater and greater because alcohol is a depressant. And if you have a tendency towards depression and you drink, it's going to even be worse. So in Kansas, in Goodland, the downtown section had two or three blocks on either side of the street. It was winter time. I had three little churches. I'd get up in the morning early and coffee cup full of sherry wine and drink it and go to the first parish and say mass and preach. Then I'd get in the car and fill up the cup again and go to the next parish and do the same thing, and then finally the third parish. And by the time I got to the third parish, I was looped. Sermons got better and better and better. And so then I'd go home, eat lunch, get up and start on the bourbon. And one evening, I had met the manager of the local theater. And he said, "Father, you can come to any movie you want, and if you want to sit upstairs, it's private up there." Because it didn't change too often. But I saw every film that came through town, and I had a plastic Tylenol bottle, one of those big ones, and I'd fill it up with bourbon, put it in my inside coat pocket, go upstairs, order a Coke, lace the Coke with the bourbon, and go into oblivion. Well, so one night, one Sunday night, I went out for a walk, and I wore cowboy boots, and everybody did, even under a cassock, and a big old black cape we wear, priests wear, and a beretta, that's the funny little hat you wear. So I put on the beretta, and the snowing outside, and I walked downtown, and on either side of the street, there were stores, but no people around. There were two bars, one at one end of town and one at the other. And one was primarily Hispanic and one was primarily Anglo. And I would pop in both bars, of course. And usually a lonely truck would amble down over the icy road, puffing smoke and crackling. I can hear it now. And I got down near the theater. And the guy who's manager of the theater was standing out there, and he was married and had two little girls, and he was having some marital problems, and I should have been giving my attention to it, but I wasn't. And he looks up at me while this kid is putting up the marquee. He said, "Hey, Father." I said, "Yeah." Because I was depressed as hell. I mean, I really was down. And I said, "Yeah." He said, "What do you do when you just can't get through to somebody?" And I turned and I said, "Fuck 'em." Now, all the money in the world couldn't force me into behavior like that today. It just couldn't. It's unbelievable. It's almost like it was another me. And indeed, it was. I remember my mother used to say, in her negativism, she used to say about Dad, when they drink, they just become more of what they are. No. No, no. We become more of what we are not when we're drinking. The true self is the sober self. We all are capable, under certain chemical influences, of becoming lower than the lowest animal. But the true self is the self that looks after proper diet and exercise and rest for the body and the mind and the spirit. All three need it and should get it. I think that pretty well summarizes my journey to this point. Again, let me say thank you for having me. Thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. And whatever religious road you travel, God bless you in it. I have a feeling when all this is over and we wind up on the other side, we're going to all sit down together at the banquet, or we won't sit down. I think we have made too many divisions. And there should be room now in the 21st century for more unity and concord in all areas of our lives. Thank you so much.